It's like tag team wrestling here. So I guess we don't have any wrestling fans out there. No. So I'm going to go first. So I'm very happy to be here to be able to talk together with you and explore together with you the teachings and life of Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Some of you are already familiar with who he is and a little bit about his legacy, and some of you probably less, and some of you not at all. So I was looking at I have some pictures in my wallet, and I was looking at them today. So I've got this picture, for example, Sir Wilfrid Laurier. And here's this. This is Sir John A. MacDonald. I have his picture in my wallet. And since I go to the United States every once in a while, I've got a picture of George Washington. And let's see who else I have in here. Andrew Jackson. And I even have a Benjamin in here, as they like to say. Right? Making some Benjamins, huh? Okay. I'll put the Benjamin out here. We'll see what happens. So, if you're part of a group or a society and they put pictures of people around like this, supposedly you're supposed to know a little something about them and what their legacy is and what they stand for and how they influence your life and, you know, why they would be on money, for example. So here, I don't know, we have a big picture of Trungpa Rinpoche here. So the same thing applies here. And I think actually we try to have a little bit more familiarity with Chögyam Trungpa than most of us have with Sir Wilfrid Laurier around here. Because this tradition and the type of Buddhism that's practiced here is based on relationships. And in fact, a lineage of relationships, we call it, stretching back very far in time. And the way that I was taught and we were taught, we learned what the meditators who went before us learned and taught. And we came to understand how those people could still have a living reality for us, even though they're not alive and present at this time. And it's very important, this kind of tradition. So I think it feels like to me that's what we're trying to do tonight and tomorrow, is to have some understanding of who is Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche and what does his life and example and teachings mean in terms of everything that goes on in this building and the type of Buddhism that's taught here. And I don't think I need to say any more than that. So it's tonight's mainly Carolyn's show, and I'm going to be helping her. I'm going to put my money away now. Okay. All right, I'll leave the Benjamin out
there. All right.
We'll see if it's still there.
Thank you, Barry. You want to tag me? Okay. I'd like to thank the Chronicles of Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche for having the inspiration for this program, along with some of you, I think, and also the Halifax Shambhala Center for hosting us here this weekend. I would like, actually, before we get into anything else, to just begin with a poem. And as many of you might know, among his many occupations in life, professions, Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche was a poet, and a number of his poems have been published in several volumes. And this is one that I thought for me was some kind of inspiration for what we're doing this weekend. It's entitled Early Testimony, Sun Will Never Set. Eagle-eating snake, according to the Mexicans, was the foundation of Mexico City. Similarly, in our case, thundering dragon, expanding Garuda, fiery tiger, snowy lion. No human being is afraid of death. We are all terrified of death. We seek for all kinds of possibilities of avoiding death and illness. Occasional fortunes help us to avoid death and disasters in life. However, in speaking with genuine appreciation of cause and effect, sunset and sunrise, we cannot avoid such calamity. It is not really calamity. It is a haphazard joke that is being played on us. We are experiencing birth, death, old age, and so forth. That is not particularly a joke, but it is a sense of humor of some kind, nonetheless. Out of those situations, we come up with true experience of life. Powerful death, powerful sickness, powerful old age, powerful birth. We could use those as strength to enliven ourselves. Those problems, so-called problems, are not regarded as obstacles. We can bring up our children properly and let them have good education of the world, telling them world is not so kind, not so cruel. Our world is just like climate. We cannot blame the winter or invite the summer. Let us tell our children to learn to be decent, that they do not have to be heroic or ordinary, unless they choose so. Children are good. They learn our message simultaneously by watching us. So we take pride in warriorship, even though we might be sunken in dirt, a naked child, even though we might be frozen to death in Eskimo land. Whatever the case may be, we regard it as the warrior path, in which we march along and reality is there as we march. Shambhalians might experience alienation. We might be regarded as weirdos. Still, as is said in the text of Shambhala, when the warrior finds cowardice, that is the beginning of fearlessness. It's really a privilege to have the opportunity to talk about Chögyam Trungpa and his life and his teachings. And it's especially a privilege to do that with people under the age of 40. It's an even greater privilege, I think, under the age of 30. We may not have too many opportunities. In that, you have a particular connection, and you have a particular path, and you have a particular potential in relationship to the Vidyadhara, Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche, that is really worth celebrating and exploring, I think. It would be fair to say that everyone in this room, if you were to reach out and touch someone, as they say, anyone in here, that you would only have, you would either be touching someone who knew the Vidyadhara or who knew someone who did, which means that you all stand no more than one degree of separation from him and his life. Some of you may know quite a lot about him. Some of you may know very little. But nevertheless, it's very different than, let us say, 200 years from now, when you wouldn't be able to find anybody who had ever met the man. And the question would be, could you find an unbroken lineage of people who could connect themselves back? As Barry was saying, that is a big issue, is what is lineage really consists of all of us and what we do with what we know, what we experience, how we use it in life, and how we pass it on to others, whether we're talking about Buddhist lineage or anything else. I think one of the things that made Rinpoche so unique and which we all benefit from tremendously is that he had this tremendous passion for the West, and he had tremendous belief in in the people that he met and tremendous trust in his students. Sometimes when people describe various forms of Buddhism, they talk about different schools. But another way that people sometimes talk about how Buddhism has been presented is that there is kind of Buddhism that is intended for the leaders and Buddhism that is intended kind of for the peasants. And in traditional societies in which Buddhism has been the dominant religion, it's often the case that there's a very small number of people who are expected to become the future leaders of the Buddhist world, and they're trained extensively. And then there is a large, you know, group of people who are going to have some heart connection with the teachings, but they're not ever going to go all that far. And so they receive teachings that will help them in their life, but that aren't necessarily intended to produce teachers at the end of all of this. Or, and it's not really intended, there are people who would say that anyone can achieve enlightenment in one lifetime. But there might also be people who would say really enlightenment is going to be achieved by very few people in this category of leaders, and that the rest of the populace is going to benefit a little bit and maybe develop a little good karma, and that the reason to practice or learn the teachings or receive teachings is just to improve your situation a little bit. Chögyam Trungpa Rinpoche very much believed that all of his students not only could but should attain significant understanding and sanity in one lifetime, and that he many times talked about how his students would become teachers. And so the training that he gave his students, hundreds of his students, if not thousands of his students, was training that in Tibet would really have been reserved for very few people within the society in most situations. And probably one of the reasons he was influenced in that was that one of his own teachers, Kempo Gangshar, who was one of his last teachers in Tibet, decided at the point where the Chinese were about to overrun the society and really destroy a lot, that he wanted to teach to lay people, and he had big teachings in which he wanted to teach anyone who would come. And in Tibet, women couldn't go into the monasteries, except maybe once a year or something. They had a reason why they could, but most of the time they were not allowed to even be in the monasteries. But he wanted everybody to come together and receive these teachings. And I don't know that that was what influenced Rinpoche, but I think it had a big impact on his life, seeing the importance of communicating to the whole society, especially when it was in a situation of crisis. And I suppose you could say that when he came to the West, that he was encountering a society that was, in a sense, in a big transition, not the same kind of crisis as he encountered in Tibet, but it was, whoever said, my parents in the 70s, it was kind of an alternate reality of sorts. There was a lot of forms in the society that were changing and that made it uniquely a great time for Buddhism to arrive as a practicing tradition. Before that, it really had been the beats were interested in it, and there were a number of scholars who were interested in it, but it just took off as an actual practicing tradition at this time in the early 70s, and not just from Tibetan Buddhists, but also from Zen Buddhist teachers coming and Theravadan teachers bringing meditation practice as it's taught in Southeast Asia. So there was a huge infusion of new teachings. And Rinpoche loved that. He loved all of the Buddhist traditions. He had tremendous respect for them. And he immediately began taking things from all over the place and incorporating it into what he presented and the path that he developed with his students. Not only that, but he worked with his students and took from them, not always, but often, their ideas, and incorporated that into how he was presenting the teachings. So when we think, when you were asking what form, what is Shambhala, or what is Shambhala Buddhism, is it really Tibetan Buddhism? It has many elements that come from that tradition, and as Alicia, I think, was saying, we've been given a very thorough and traditional approach to Buddhism through his teachings. But at the same time, for example, when people start to practice Buddhism in Tibet, they don't sit. They sit in in Zen monasteries. They sit in the Theravadan tradition, but sitting meditation, as we practice it, is really not practiced by Tibetans. Maybe now they'll take it up. But already, when Rinpoche came to America, he began to incorporate a lot of things from other places. He sent a bunch of his students to Zen Center to study with the San Francisco Zen Center to study with Suzuki Roshi, and he had students who came from San Francisco Zen Center, and as a result, we have things like Weektons and Datuns, which I don't think existed. There were long practice periods in Tibet, but certainly that wasn't the way that you were introduced to practice. Also, he, I think, understood that it was likely that Buddhism would be practiced by householders, by what we call lay people, and he didn't just think that it would be some little thing that people would do, but he actually felt that people could be fully engaged with society and at the same time fully engaged with practice. And again, some of the forms, the way in which he approached the development of all the forms that we have was very much more like Japanese Buddhism than like Tibetan Buddhism. So, for example, we do things like, it's not just that we do things like flower arranging in our community, or we have some people practice Kudo, the way of the bow, which are actual Japanese forms. But the interesting thing in Japan was that they took almost every aspect of daily life and turned it and treated it as something that could have mindfulness and discipline and wakefulness within it. In Tibetan monasteries, most of the disciplines were really religious disciplines. They weren't really secular disciplines. But Rinpoche was completely fascinated by the idea that anything in life, from how you speak the English language to your table manners, what you wear, how you set up your house, anything that you do, could be a vehicle for basic goodness, a vehicle for some kind of experience of sanity. So those are a few of the ways in which we all benefit from the fact that he, and not just us, but pretty much everyone who is practicing Buddhism in the West has probably to some degree been influenced by how he presented the teachings. The language that he used, the forms that he developed, and he was just here early enough, and in a sense the playing field was really quite open. So while many things have changed and developed, at the same time many, many people, I think, would even say, if they knew him, that they were heavily influenced by him. Many of the teachers who are now getting along, I don't know whether all of their students would know how influenced they've been. But so, I think I don't want to go on too long tonight. We want to start fresh in the morning. And do you want to say a little bit about what you're going to do tomorrow morning? And
then we'll, yeah, sure. Mm-hmm. So tomorrow morning we'll do a basic meditation instruction, reasonable period of meditation. It won't kill you. So we'll go through basic posture and the kind of simple meditation practice we do, and then walking meditation. So the way in which, I think Carolyn was just talking about some of the ways that Trungpa Rinpoche worked with developing something on the spot that was both traditional and related to the people and the time period. And the way that he taught a basic meditation practice already contained in it a tremendous quality of power and spaciousness from the tradition that he came out of, which is quite a colorful and powerful and energetic tradition, even though it's a simple meditation practice. So that's the style of meditation practice we'll do tomorrow. And I have one other thing I wanted to say. basically starting now, we're all absolutely, totally at the same level. So we're not ranking. There's no ranking happening. This is really one of the most powerful teachings that I picked up off of Trungpa Rinpoche that I think, you know, we all did. If you, you'd go into a unique situation with him and you're meeting new people, often the people around him, we would kind of feel like we had to create some really important distance, almost artificially. Like, he's the important guy, and here are the lesser people. But he cut right through that, and everybody was on the ground floor together all the time. And I think that's very important, that we're not, in Zen they say, a true man without rank. Ray, that's ranking, so true human being without rank. does that make sense? So all we're all at the same level, and I include myself in that. Not Carolyn. I am not worthy. I am not worthy.
Do I get the?
No. I may admire you, but I'm not giving you a Benjamin. You can have.
Oh, George.
You can have George, okay. And he's not worth as much. So anyway, that's, I think, all I wanted to say, so we could have some questions, as Carolyn said.
I'd like to know how we can practice Buddhism in our daily lives, just at meditation and action, basically. Thank you.
You've got the mind.
Well, I'm assuming that's something that you'd like to learn about over the course of the weekend rather than a, you know, one-shot deal question. But I can give you the short answer is just do it. Isn't that Nike? Hey, Trungpa Rinpoche said that before Nike. Yeah, really.
You are listening to Dharma Classes on Chronicles Radio, a production of the Chronicles of Chogyam Trungpa Rinpoche. Tune in next week for Class 2 of the Essential Chogyam Trungpa series. Support for Chronicles Radio comes from our listeners. To contribute, visit chroniclesradio.com, where you can make a donation in dollars, loonies, euros, or pounds. To bring this episode to a close, here's James Thorpe singing Moonlight from his album Aphrodite.
Do you think the sun shines just for you? Well, it's true, you know it shines through. But in case you didn't notice, it shines on everyone else too. Yeah, it's true. Thank you. before you float away and leave confusion in your way. Just remember that the sun sets.